Well, folks, we've got 24 check-ins tonight. That is a record for this particular net, not for the Wednesday night net. But anyway, I think we had a few people that had questions, not necessarily about our topic, but something else. Would someone like to ask one of those questions? Please come back right now.
KE0KBS.
Go ahead, please, sir.
Okay, just a quick question. Was just something I kind of was learned about over this weekend with the contest. What is up five?
Boy, I could guess, but Mark W2MIC, you have any idea what that could be?
Sure, but Cooch is the guy to ask.
Well, OJ, go ahead. You're the master DXer. K0OJ, are you there?
Oh, I was laying on the bed. He's listening up five. You transmit five below that. Up five, up 10, up 7. So that means you're going to have to learn how to use your rig on the split mode.
Okay, well, that means I'll have to do a little more reading in the manual there, because, yeah, I don't know how you do that.
Well, my rig, if I wanted to do something like that, I have two choices. Either do the A and B VFO and set the B VFO 5KC higher than the A one and then hit split, and then it will do it. Or if I'm on VFO, I can use the multi thingy. I don't know that yours does or doesn't have something like that. They just give it one click and it will take the VFO up five. If you're on an even, that's fine. If you're on an odd, well, it'll just go to the next 5KC slot. Like if you're on three, it'll go up five. So anyway, they were listening up 5KC. A lot of the DXers do that so that the people who won't shut up might be up there, and then he can transmit, and people will hear him without all the people in the way, as it were. Sometimes they're up 10, sometimes they're up or down, or you know, whatever, but it just means kilocycles. He was listening up 5KC.
Okay, now is that similar to what we're doing here with the repeater, where, you know, I'm talking on 442, but listening at 447?
Well, yes, similar, but not the same thing, as it were. This is a whole nother deal.
Okay, well, I know we had a topic for tonight, so we don't need to necessarily get in the weeds here, and maybe that's something I'll pick your brain about one of these days.
Okay, well, I was laying on my bed, so if you have something for me, give me time to get there, Joe. K0OJ.
I will, OJ. Dean, I'm not sure about the 9100, but this 1200 has got a button on it that says split, and that's what that's for. It's not split. Does your 991 have that button on there?
Yeah, I do see a button that says split. I didn't know that's what that was for.
Yeah, that's what that's for, and I think you can set it, as OJ says, for 5 or 7 or 10 or something like that. I think the default is 5, if I remember right, on it. The only reason I know that is because there was a YouTube video on the 1200, and that's where I found out about the split.
Okay. Well, I'll do a little more reading the manual here and learn about it, because I didn't realize that's what they were referring to.
Does anybody else have any comments for Dean about that? I be honest with you, OJ, that was brilliant because I thought it was basically just go up five, but yeah, I forgot about the split. Does anybody else have anything for Dean, please? Okay, are there any other generic questions for our group tonight? Please call now.
KE0KAW with a question.
KAW, it's you're up.
So I'm in Fort Collins, and I'm just wondering, I'm not in an HOA, but I'm wondering if anybody knows if there are any municipal, codes or anything like that as far as whether towers are allowable or not.
Go ahead, Mike.
Towers are allowed up to 40 feet, and I think it can go beyond that. You'll have to look at the height code, but the average height code in Fort Collins itself for anything is 40 feet.
Are there any permits that would need to be pulled for that, or is that just something you can do on your own?
I just recently looked at that because I was putting a wind tower up, and there was some stipulation in there for ham radio operators. I think you're exempt. I would look into it. You just go to LarimerCounty.org and look in the building department, and you can find the, just type in ham radio and it'll pop right up.
Okay, perfect. That answers my questions. KE0KAW, back to net.
I'd like to add one thing that we're looking into now. Are you near some sort of municipal airport? They have different rules.
Nope, I'm over on the southeast side, not close to anything special.
Okay, I just want to make sure because we're looking into that now in Greeley, and we think we're close to an airport, so we have some restrictions for those guys. So anyway, any other comments? Okay, are there any other generic questions for the net? Please call. This is Kilo Delta Zero Tango Yankee Uniform Net Control for this evening's TechNet, sponsored by the Northern Colorado Amateur Radio Club. Just want to let everybody know that you do not have to have an extremely technical question for this net. If you've got a simple one, that's even better, actually, for me. But please, and you do not need to be a member of the club to join in, for golly's sakes, please, please do. So are there any other questions for the net before we go on to our topic?
N0WIQ.
N0WIQ, go ahead, Kerry.
I was asking about controlling presentation software on my computer with a remote device, and I was just wondering, it was suggested that I'd ask the question on this net.
I guess I'm a little confused. You're talking about a PowerPoint presentation or something else?
Well, with my LibreOffice, there's a program called Impress that is a presentation maker. And so I can open up a file that I've made with it and put it into a slideshow. And I want to control the slideshow with something remote.
Well, I don't think you were at the meeting on Saturday, but I do this for a living, so I know a little bit about it. I'm using PowerPoint, of course, which is probably something similar to what you're using, and I use a presenter, and all it is a little clicker that uses a USB port on your drive. And it will automatically switch the slides from one to another. Mine has got laser pointer on it, and it also has an audio control because I can control my audio from it also. Mine's a little bit more sophisticated, but that it's called a presenter. I think that's what you're looking for.
Called a presenter. Well, that's a term I haven't used in my searches, but I have found something that looks pretty nice. Is they call it a finger trackball, which with a laser pointer built into it. So I'm pretty sure it would do the job too.
Yeah, I buy a bunch of them. I usually buy three or four. Although this bunch has lasted a long time. I can buy, you can buy them at Staples, you can buy them at Office Depot, and you can pay 30, 40 bucks for them. I buy the same one on eBay. I think I buy, I can pay $3 or $4 for them. I usually get 10 for three, or I get three for $10, and they usually last me about, well, these guys here have lasted me about 4 years now. So there's just a AA battery in the thing, and the batteries last literally forever. So if that's what you're looking for, like I said, there's a little USB plug-in to your computer. I don't know how it works with Linux, to be honest with you, but I do know it does work with Office. Mark, have you had any experience with working with Linux with a presenter or a clicker, as I call it?
W2MIC, none. I'm a Windows guy, and I use a high-end Microsoft brand presentation mouse that is a mouse on top, and when you flip it over, it is a laser pointer and Bluetooth buttons to control PowerPoint. But that's all built into Windows courtesy of Microsoft. On Linux, we need to find somebody else.
Does anybody out there work with Linux and know how you do a presentation with that, please?
W0DBZ. Most of the presenters that you use are based on keyboard drivers, so they're just basically the arrow keys on your keyboard. Most of them will work in Linux PCs or Macintosh.
Well, there you go, Kerry. Dave would know for sure. He works with the things daily.
Well, Joe, I have some lightning arresters, and I don't really know quite where to hook them up at or whatever. I just been during the thunderstorm season, just been putting the disconnecting my antenna and putting it in a glass jar, and in the off chance that I get hit with lightning, I don't know what else I could do other than that. See, I have the lightning arresters, but I really don't know how to use them.
Well, N0WIQ, you want to address that for him, Kerry?
Okay, when I have used them, I had mounted them at the plate that I have on the side of my house for a feed-through for the cables. And so they went in between the cable from the antenna and the cable onto the rest of my rig. But, and they had a screw arm so you could run to a ground garage when they arc. And that was what I saw on lightning protectors. Now, Mark probably has a better feel for some of this stuff because he put in what is called an alpha lightning system, which is probably the best you can do, although you're never going to protect yourself from a direct strike. It's just a matter of making yourself less appealing to lightning strikes in the area.
W2MIC, would you care to comment on that?
Sure, lots of comments. W2MIC, there are three different regimes we're dealing with here. One of them is a direct strike where the lightning hits your antenna, mast, whatever, house. The second is a near strike, so within a couple miles. And the third regime is a far strike. We'll do the direct hit first. There's absolutely nothing you can do. As the old saying goes, slightly rewritten for a family-oriented repeater, bend over, grab your ankles, kiss your posterior goodbye. A lightning strike carries about 10 billion watts. That's B as in Bravo. It will run up to 120,000 amperes. There's nothing you can do. If you take a direct hit, it's going to fry your equipment, it's going to come down your cable, it's going to zap you, it's going to set your house on fire, it's going to do all kinds of bad stuff. So where we can have some influence is in the near hit and the not quite so near hit, and I will drop and come back up here. The general idea is that you ground your tower, your support system. So if you have a tower that is sunk into concrete in the ground, you need to put in a ground rod separately and tie the base of the tower to the ground rod. That makes the tower carry inductive coupled energy from a near strike into the ground. And so if you have a pole sitting next to your house and tied to the soffit, you need to ground that pole. If, like me, you have a tripod up on the apex of your roof, and then you've got a mast in the tripod, you need to ground that tripod, and probably ground the pole as well. And when I say ground, that means you need a ground rod, which is typically an 8-foot-long steel rod, copper-coated, that you have sunk into the ground, literally. Drop and come back. So your number one line of defense is put a ground rod in right next to your support, tower, pole, crank up, tilt up, tripod, whatever the heck you've got. The second layer of defense, so we've taken care of the tower proper, the support proper, and now we have to cope with the fact that a lightning strike will induce current in the isolated portions of your antenna and put potentially hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of volts down your coax, where the voltage runs between the shield of the coax and the center conductor. The minimum protection is disconnect your equipment when lightning is coming in, and either put your the tip of your coax in a jar, because there will be sparks between the center conductor and the shield. Or, as I do, build yourself a shorting bar, which is just a bulkhead connector with the center connector shorted to the bulkhead, and that will short the antenna pieces together, and you will not get a differential voltage. Both work. No matter what, I absolutely do disconnect my gear. So I disconnect my antenna, I put a shorting bar on, and I recommend that everybody do that, because no lightning protection is perfect. The third layer of protection is you get what is called a lightning arrestor, and I'm going to drop and come back. And a lightning arrestor, such as those made by Polyphaser, P-O-L-Y-P-H-A-S-E-R, like poly and then a Star Trek phaser, it is a connector, it's a barrel connector that goes in between two pieces of coax, and the lightning arrestor has a gas tube inside that will carry AC, RF, alternating current radio frequency, but will not carry direct current. And so when the voltage goes up from a distant lightning strike or a near lightning strike, the gas tube will short with a duration of microseconds and will carry the current down to ground and not pass the current through to your radio and not cause noise on your radio. Any of these lightning arrestors need to be grounded. And there are two different flavors. One of them sits at the base of the tower. So you have your antenna on top of the tower, the coax comes down the tower, you have a ground rod at the base of the tower, and you have a lightning arrestor at the base of the tower. So the coax comes down the tower to the lightning arrestor is connected to a ground rod, and then you have the coax come the rest of the way into your house, to your radio, etc. I recommend that you bury that second piece of coax. A second version, one that I have and one that I think Carrie has, is you bring all of your coax to a big copper panel, and on the copper panel you mount these polyphaser or MFJ lightning arrestors, and you then ground the panel with a very high conductivity connection, usually thick copper foil. A wire is not sufficient, and braid is not sufficient. Generally speaking, any of these will cost you about $100 per coax. It's cheaper to do the ground at the tower, because that means you've got one cable coming down and one arrestor. If you do the panel version that I have, the panel will cost you around $100, and each of the individual arrestors will cost you around $100. That's a lot of money, and it's way cheaper than replacing a multi-$1,000 HF radio. Joe, that was a lot. Back to you.
No, both you and Carrie always service me well, very well. Matt, did that help you?
Well, it's a starting point, I mean. But I suppose the thing that I really need to consider doing is just grounding my tripod up on the roof. And does rebar work just the same as a grounding rod over?
It can. A real grounding rod that you'll find at Home Depot or Lowe's going to run you, what, Joe, $15-$20? W0RF Radio Dan likes a different solution. He takes a thick copper pipe and pounds the end shut and then drives it into the ground, and that also works well. The problem with a pure piece of rebar is it rusts, and rust is not terribly conductive.
Oh, I never thought about that. You're right. I probably should scrap that idea, but I will do the copper pipe. I'll go out and purchase one and run a high thickness of copper wire from my tripod down to the grounding rod. Over.
Yep, that's what I do. And then I position my, some of my ground rods at the output of my downspouts. That way they get as much water as I can possibly manage.
Oh, to intensify the effects of the ground, I see.
Correct.
Oh, that sounds reasonable. But, you know, but I've always, you know, the guy back home in Nebraska, he always told me, Matt, if you're going to get into ham radio, you've got to make sure you have a big old glass jug near your radio to put your antenna leads in. And he was telling about a story that happened to a friend of his in Kansas. got a direct strike on his antenna, and it busted the glass, but that was about it. So, you know, I'd rather have a bust glass than a fried Kenwood.
M0WIQ.
Go ahead, Gary.
Well, as Morgan and I have said, anything resembling a direct strike is going to do more than take your radio out. So it's just one of those things. Everything else is just making your equipment less susceptible to a lightning strike. So you're less likely to get the direct strike. And hey, it's basically do what you're comfortable with, what you can afford nicely, whatever, because you can spend many dollars into things that, yeah, each thing might make an improvement, but do you need any improvement after the first thing kind of thing? I mean, this is a reasoning situation that you have to have some feeling for lightning in the first place, and then you go from there.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Carrie. It's just, it's so important to do that because I've seen lightning strikes and what they can do and everything, being from Nebraska, and you know, we all have lightning storms out here, but boy, back home they have some real doozies. Over.
Yes, and this high desert, dry land, especially dry this year in this area. Dry land makes a worse conductor than moist land. As Mark mentioned, keeping it as moist as you can where the ground rod is makes the ground rod work better. I'll put it that way.
I never thought of it, but, you know, it does make sense. You know, I took enough physics in college to be dangerous, so, and I do remember conductivity and all that stuff, so, yeah, that's a good idea. I think I'll invest and go do that, and hopefully it'll all be never needed.
That is the correct idea, so be careful and probably use an 8-foot stick of copper tubing or pipe, but anyway, the more pipe you can put in the ground, the better it's going to be, too. And there's plenty of tricks for sinking a ground rod into the ground, like putting a trickle of water down next to the rod so you can just push it into the ground, things like that. But, hey, every little trick makes the job easier.
Well, I have access to one of those electric wire fence post drivers. Yeah, they look like a sledge, you know, or a door buster. You know what the cops use to bust down doors. But what you do is you just use that to pound your fence post in, and that'll probably work on at least a half-inch pipe or whatever.
the farm was something like a 3-inch pipe or something like that that it would hold, and we used it to dry steel fence posts in back in Nebraska. But out here, you run into a situation where you just might want to soak up the ground pretty good as you're going to put one in, just in case you run into a rock where you decided to put it, and you want the rock to be able to move.
Oh yeah, definitely. I pulled up one of those puppies, and I only had a 6-foot ground rod, and I about hurt myself doing that.
Go ahead, Joe.
James, W0JBR, your questions to add to this interesting topic.
Thank you, Joe. W0JBR. A few years ago, my girlfriend and I were on an aluminum fishing boat at Boyd Lake, and we were fishing in a thunderstorm. And my graphite pole started buzzing, and I went to grab it, and I couldn't even touch it. So it was on that day that I learned that lightning comes from not only the sky, but from the ground as well. Does this phenomenon happen with ham radio towers as well? And is that the purpose of the grounding rod, to make the tower less appealing to lightning, is my first question.
Interesting. Anybody want to take that?
KD0GW, I'll take that.
Stand to reason that it would, you know. I mean, if we have grounding rods and everything, it probably, you know, it'd probably do that. And they say that a lightning actually travels from the ground up. Now, I don't know whether how they prove that or not, but anyway, that stuff is to be very respected no matter what you call it.
Well, Matt, we have a meteorologist on board here, works for the government. And KD0ZW, I heard you cut in there. Go right ahead, you got it.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, I'm speaking to the basic physics of lightning. It is a discharge of a polarity. The charge is developed from cloud convection and the fact that there's upwelling, and the atmosphere rubs against itself, essentially, like you're rubbing your a balloon against your head. But you have a large charge distribution, charge difference between the clouds and the ground. And when you get a lightning discharge, this is a current. And a current, like if you're going to connect to battery, you have to have a conductor, and that conductor is the atmosphere. And positive charge flows from one end and negative charge flows from the other. So you're going to get high electric fields on the ground, you're going to get high electric fields from the clouds all the way. So this whole thing, you have current flowing in all directions, in the direction of the lightning strike, but there is large voltage differences everywhere from the cloud to the ground. KD0ZWU.
WIQ, go.
Well, we have talked this evening about grounding towers, and that is effectively saying the tower is a lightning rod, and you ground it so it is less appealing to the lightning. But if lightning does come close enough, it will have enough current to go to the grounding rod, and that's the basic crux of it. So, I mean, yeah, we kind of have to talk about current when we're amateur radio operators. And current is a basic flow caused by moving electrons within conductors. And so the bigger the wire, the more current it can carry. And things like that. Of course, there's probably a financial limitation you might run into that says it's only practical to make it this size. That is after you price some of these bigger wires. I mean, or you might want to use a big wire over a short distance to keep the price down, things like that, but yeah. We're talking about massive amounts of current, potentially possible, yeah, big word, yeah. Anyway, and it's still probably a good idea to disconnect the cable. Excuse me, I bumped the button. Anyway, you probably want to take the feed line off the radio and stick it in a glass jar, put a shorting bar across it in the meantime, things like that, like Mark suggested. And no matter what you do to preserve the property with the antenna, the house, everything else, you gotta go into this simple idea of taking the feed line off and putting it in the glass jar.
W2MIC.
W2MIC, go ahead.
Some observations on several of the comments. First, a lightning rod system is not what we're talking about here. A lightning rod system, such as you would see on the top of a building, or when I was growing up in southern Minnesota, on top of a barn or a silo, is a tall rod higher than anything else around with a very sharp point. And one of the cool things about sharp points and electrical fields is the electrical field at a sharp point goes almost infinite. And what that does is bleeds off the difference in charge between the earth, the soil, the dirt, and the clouds. And so it will either prevent a lightning strike or it will take one. I've seen both. That's not what we're talking about doing with amateur radio antennas. What we're talking about doing is grounding the support structure, the mast, the tower, the tripod, etc., simply so that when there is a near or far strike, the induced current has a path down to the soil. We are not putting sharp pointy things up on top of our antenna towers. We are not installing a lightning prevention system.
WA9FBL.
Good evening, Bob. Do you have a comment?
Evening, Joe. Yes, sir. I've been monitoring for a little bit here. I'd like to modify something that was said earlier about you can't do anything about a direct lightning hit. The equipment just simply goes away. Well, two-way commercial installations, broadcasters, all that kind of stuff, they get hit all the time. And they build their sites so that they can handle that kind of energy. Everything that's been discussed tonight and a lot more is free for the downloading. Go to the internet and do a Google search for Motorola R56. The Motorola R56 manual, I think the last edition was 2005, is downloadable, has everything from ground rods to soil connectivity and what part of the country gets hit most by lightning and putting in strapping and grounding and everything. And it's the standard followed by pretty much everybody in the two-way business. So, WA9FBL.
I stand corrected.
That's interesting to know, Bob. I appreciate that comment. W0JBR, any other questions? We hope you do.
Yeah, W0JBR. So basically, after we came to our senses and got the boat out of the water, and then we realized that we were basically going to become a path for a lightning strike, is that the purpose of the ground rod for a tower to kind of prevent that buildup of a static charge? And with putting an 8-foot piece of pipe in the ground, what size cable do you recommend connecting the tower to? Is there a particular size, be it 2 or 1 or 1-0, or what do you recommend as far as the size connecting the tower to that ground rod?
Short answers would be yes and as big as your wallet will permit.
And is doing just one leg of the tower good enough, or is it more effective to do each leg of the tower, all three legs?
One is sufficient because the cross-leg support structures are welded, so they are very good conductors.
Now,
and ground rods separated by 3 feet are not independent. KD0, ZWU.
The same sensation I did with my graphite fishing pole, and then come to discover I'm in the path of something that's not good. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for your answers. W0JBR, back to you, Joe. Thank you.
James, we had a good double there. In fact, half of your conversation was cut out. But Terry, your comment first, and then let's go back to James for what he was saying. Go ahead.
James, on multiple grounds on towers, the ground rods, if they're not separated by more than 10 feet, they're not independent, so they're redundant.
Thank you. And that actually brings up a pretty good question. Is there a certain distance that I should have the ground rod from the tower, or is it okay to have it pretty close, or is there a certain distance?
Closer is better because the ground wire actually imposes an inductance, and you don't want the inductance to prevent the high the lightning strike from being conducted to ground.
Sounds good. Like I was saying at my last transmission, I just didn't want it to be where I felt that same sensation where I grabbed my graphite fishing pole and discovered that I was going to be in the path of not something good. I didn't want to have that happen where I go out to the tower and go to touch it and feel that same sensation of static charge building up in it. And I just wanted to thank all the gentlemen for their answers tonight. W0JBR.
Thanks, James, for that. But I guess it brings up a question for me. If I had some double aught welding wire or something like that, that's pretty big stuff, and I had 2 feet of this stuff and ran myself an eight foot ground rod all the way, you know, into the ground, clamp it down, you mean that that's all I need for that tower? Well, that's not really bad when you figure that, if you only need a couple, 3 feet of this stuff, that's not as bad as having, you know, coax at a buck a foot, you got to run 100 feet. So that's not really too bad because I think you could probably find some recycled stuff, out here at Waste Knot or something like that. If you just need that short of thing there, that might be something to look at.
KBF with a question.
Go ahead, Dean.
Okay, this is in regards to if the ground rods aren't spaced more than 10 feet. Now, I don't have a tower because my antennas are just mounted to the back deck on the railing. And one of the gentlemen had told me that I really should run a separate ground rod for each antenna, but now my antennas are only, I don't know, we'll say they might be 10 feet apart. I really doubt it because my deck's only 20 to begin with, so probably like 7-8 foot at max between the two antennas. Would I be better served running a separate ground rod to each antenna, or just run one in between them and then, yeah, and get some, you know, welding cable and run from each antenna to that single ground rod?
W2MIC.
Go ahead, Mark.
I believe I was the person with whom you had that discussion, and I initially suggested a separate ground rod per antenna until I got a better grasp of the dimensions. If your antennas are maybe 10 or less feet apart, put a single ground rod in between them and connect them. You do need to be, especially with our dry soil, 10 feet or more apart in order to have the ground rods function independently. given that you've got two different antennas, maybe 10, perhaps less feet apart, may as well just put one ground rod in the middle and run wires from the masts over to the single ground rod.
Okay, and now another question, though, is if I do that, now I currently have a ground rod just for, basically just for the RF ground that I have, a 14-gauge wire ran from both antennas and also runs into the basement here where I have the power supply and my radio ground wires. I'm only going to, I don't think I'll even be 10 feet away from the current ground rod, so is any problems there?
I would really like to have your station ground going to a different ground rod than your mast grounds. Those are different circuits, if at all possible, because the tower is, or the mast, as you may have, is not connected to the coax, not to the shield and not to the center conductor. If you use a single ground rod to ground your masts and your station, you have just tied your support masts to your radio chassis, and that's something I really do not want to have you doing, if possible. So the answer would be I'd really like to see two different ground rods, ideally 10 or more feet apart, with your station chassis tied to one of them and your radio support masts tied to a different ground rod. Tying them all together is better than doing nothing, but I really don't want to have the masts act as charge collectors to then push that charge into the chassis of the radio.
Okay, well, I've got the utility companies coming back out because I had them locate where I wanted to put my ground rod. Well, they only located up to that spot. They didn't actually finish showing where the cables go, so I don't know where I can put the other ground rod for the antenna. So if I can get that a second ground rod, and then I'll just basically put those between the two masts, I'll disconnect the other wire that I have running back to basically my chassis ground for the power supply and the radio, so that I'll have that wire going to the existing ground, and I'll have the two masts tied to the new ground rod. Does that sound right?
Much better. And if possible, bury the coax running from the base of the support masts into the house. That way you get at least some shielding from strikes on the cable, and literally burying the cable will help prevent that charge from coming through.
Okay. Yeah, I can do that, because right now it's just ran on the ground, kind of, you know, I have it run along the edge of the deck, and then it runs along the foundation of the basement around the corner of the house until it comes in. And then I think somebody else, and it may have been you, had said that I really should break the coax before it enters the house and run another ground from the in or from the outside wall of the house back to that rod, instead of just running a straight piece of coax from the radio to the antenna.
Yeah, in your case, if you put in a metal bulkhead, Polyphaser and others make both through panel bulkhead connectors, so you would ground the panel, the pass-through panel, whether that's a window or coming through a wall or whatever, to its own ground rod, and then put the lightning interrupters on that metal panel. And that way there would be one coax coming up to the panel, and then the lightning interrupter, and then the second coax, where the panel and the lightning interrupters will protect whatever is inside from whatever's happening outside.
Okay, well, I'll tell you, you know, it'd be great if I could get you or somebody that, you know, understands this a little better than I do, maybe come over and take a look at my shack. We'll see where I've got the antenna set up, and, you know, now that we're in the winter, I don't have to worry too much about lightning, which is kind of why I've set it up the way I am right now, because I'm not too worried about having a lightning strike here in, you know, in November, December, but I can get all this taken care of before spring.
W2MIC, Joe, I think we just heard a request for a visiting Elmer.
Yeah, for sure. I'm still curious about, of course, I don't have anything grounded. I used to have stuff grounded, but I don't anymore. Dean, are you looking to for just a lightning ground or also a static ground for your radios?
Well, I guess, you know, whatever I need.
WA9FBL.
Bob, you're an expert. Go ahead.
No, but I know where to go to get answers. The latest issue of QST Magazine has an article on exactly this topic, and in fact, they don't want you to put in all these separate grounds unless you bond them all together with the house wiring ground, because otherwise you're in violation of the National Electrical Code. And we all recognize that long ground wires look like high impedances to RF, but that doesn't matter. Safety-wise, these grounds have to all be tied together, because who's to say which ground is going to look the most attractive to the lightning? Which one has the lowest impedance? That's the one the lightning is going to follow. So that has to be done. And also, please, go to the internet, do a search for Motorola R56, download it. I've got a copy here in front of me. It talks all about this stuff. It shows that if you've got a tower, you're supposed to put in a number two copper ring underground around the tower and solder a separate connection from each tower leg to that ring. There's nothing in there about maintaining more than 10 feet away from the ground rods. This is the Bible, so check it out.
K0PRB.
PRB, go ahead.
Well, in everything that I've read, soldering any lightning protection is not recommended. You should always use some sort of copper clamps or any type of metal clamp and not solder anything.
Negative. I said soldering, but I didn't mean it. What I meant was Caldwell. It's much better than any other scheme, except when you're dealing directly with tower legs.
Bob, what was the name of that article?
It's a publication from Motorola called R56. So just do an internet search for Motorola R56. A bunch of sites will come up where you can download it. It's a couple hundred pages long, and it goes into great detail on everything we've talked about.
That's an excellent one. What I'll do, folks, is I'll go ahead and see if I can't get find it now and actually link it to our website. It'll be under resources and supplies, so check it out there.
KD08.
Bob, I found that article. It's a PDF file. I'll see how I can actually put that on the website. It's like you say, it's quite lengthy, so it takes some time to download, but I think it's, from what I'm looking at, the thing, it's an extremely good article.
Oh, it's been the standard for years, Joe. And if you go to page 4-50, it's got drawings and pictures about the ground rods and the requirements for the copper wire and all that good stuff. So it's all there. It was put together by people who are professionals in the two-way business with many, many years of experience, and it's pretty much the standard that two-way radio sites follow when they build their sites. So now, it may be expensive for hams to replicate all that, but at least the theory is there.
Yeah, it's quite a lengthy article, but I'm trying various ways to download it, or at least link it to something. Since the PDF, maybe I can just make it a zip file or something. We'll make it work for everybody for sure. Mark, did you have any other comments?
W2MIC, no, nothing further.
Okay. You know where I live. Yeah, if you and anybody else want to make a venture over here, I'd be happy to show everybody what I got and, you know, start making me a little grocery list of
what I need to do, you know, to make sure that we are safe.
Yeah, Dean, we'll do the. Have I got the right article? 518 pages.
The pages aren't individually numbered, so I don't know. It goes by, you know, chapters A-20 and B-64 and so on.
Well, this says external, internal grounding, power sources, surge protection, electromagnetic energy, various things. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, and chapter 4 is all about tower grounding.
By golly, it is. From introduction all the way through everything, yeah. Okay, well, I'll see if I can't get this thing posted. I'm not sure I could send it to anybody because it looks like it's quite large. I'll see what I can do when I save it. So we will try to link it or do something with the thing. If anyone wants a private copy of the thing, I can kind of tell you where to go, but that's about all I can do.
Well, and it's not, you know, really nasty engineering language with lots of math. It's written pretty much so the construction type guys can follow it. I find it very easy to understand. WA9FBL.
I totally agree with you, Bob. It does look like it's very, very simple. If I can understand it, anybody can understand it that's on this net for sure. So thank you for that, Bob. Anybody else have any anything to add? HR.
Geezer, yes.
And yes, also.
Well, we had like three guys in there, but I heard USB first. Go ahead, Mike.
Do we know the effective radius of a lightning strike?
ZWU, are you still out there, Terry?
I'm still here, but define effective.
Effective enough to destroy your radio.
Highly subjective. It depends on how well you prepared your or protected your radio.
So if a lightning strikes like a mile away and there's no interconnectivity through infrastructure, i.e. gas pipelines, phone lines, electrical lines, what's, you know, 1 mile, half mile, 3 miles, 10 miles?
Well, this is just kind of winging it, but if you have not taken any precautions for protection against nearby lightning strikes, I suspect if it's within a mile or 2 miles, you're going to receive damage to your radio. This is a very rough figure.
That's all I needed, was just a rough figure. KD0 USB, back to net.
Any other comments? Well, I think we're good. Anybody else have any comments about this? It's an interesting subject. It's more depth than what we've actually had before. So I think it's... Terry, NZOWIQ, do you have anything to add?
W7LRY, Larry, I'd like to make a comment, Joe.
Oh, boy, we're getting all the experts in here. Go right ahead, Larry.
Well, I've been listening to the probably last half of this conversation. It's been quite interesting. And a couple of comments. One, the way I handle the lightning thing, I just have a relay, a top 10 devices relay it's called, and I just reach over and flip that off when there's lightning in the area, and it automatically grounds it. Like has been said in the past, you're not going to prevent a direct hit from causing damage, but it does bleed off the static. Let me drop it here. I had a lot of, have had quite a bit of practical practice in this topic. First of all, in the electrical code, you can spend, that was the number one misunderstood topic when you do your electrician license is grounding. You could spend weeks talking about it. This is a topic that can go on forever. And back in the days when we built power lines, they would try things like these brushes, they look like a brush like you cling a chimney with sharp points, like a whole bunch of ground rods, or lightning rods, I should say. And they're not real sure, they were never real sure whether they prevented strikes or caused strikes. So some use them and some don't. I think my battery's dying on this little handheld, so I'll try to make it quick before I have to change batteries. Lightning does not seem to obey Ohm's law. It's more like a static, and I've seen it split power poles right down the middle and then go into a substation and go through a 15 amp high voltage fuse and not even phase it and then melt a transformer. So it's very unpredictable.
K0J.
K0J, go ahead.
J.
Well, I think I'd mentioned this once before, but I'll do it again for a lot of the newies and stuff. A friend of mine, old Paul Correcto, WA0BAG, used to work on mountaintop microwave sites here in the state years ago, and the one that he was working on, he said it would always go down due to strikes in the summer, and I don't know where he got the info or blah blah blah, but they had got a, I don't know how many of these all stainless steel floor push brooms, and I remember he said he got them from Los Angeles Brush Company, I think. Well, anyway, he put a mess of those up. You know, even the bristles were stainless steel, and how many I don't know, but he tied all of them into the ground. How high off the ground, I don't know either, but he said while he worked there, they never took a strike. It kept the charges bled off. So that's about the best that I know on that one.
Interesting comment. I did post that Motorola R56 in the resources and supplies area. And it is for download. Just click on the thing. It's actually on the website. You can download at that time. It's 500 some pages, but it's excellent reading for anybody who wants to create a tower or just actually learn a little bit about grounding and things like that. Great find, Bob. I appreciate that.
Break.
I don't know who said break, but go ahead.
Yeah, this is K0BIU here in Fort Collins. Just listening to the last few comments, just turned the rig on about lightning protection, and that's quite an art and a science. I'm wondering if any discussion has been had about the polyphaser write-ups on that. They have an extensive, I can't remember if it's all in one, maybe a three-phase, but it's a three-section report, but they wrote extensively about lightning protection as a part of developing their inline lightning protection devices, but it's excellent and it's backed up by good numbers and good science. Over.
I personally am not aware, but is anyone else?
W2MIC, yes, at various times 20 years ago, I've read all of it. It's excellent.
Yes.
N7GS, go ahead, Kevin.
I just wanted to ask, is that something on their website or a PDF or something that can be downloaded as well?
This is K0BIU. I'm not sure. I picked mine up, as was mentioned, 20 years ago, but I still would suggest it's timely, and I still say it's applicable to what we're doing today. Lightning hasn't changed much. The rest of the world has. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's on their website or it can be easily available. I was given a couple copies by Polyphaser back then when I went to their factory. Over.
Okay, thank you. N7GES.
Kevin, short answer is yes.
Very good. Oh, also, somebody asked a long time ago, off the subject, I'm sorry, if this was lunch week, and yes, it is. N7GES, on Wednesday at 11:30.
Yeah, that was me, and Lou Ann told me that too, so thanks for that. You just reconfirmed that I may or may not be there. That's interesting. I guess I wasn't aware of that, would someone care to spell that for me? Polyphasers, at P-O-L-Y-P-H-A-S-O-R or something?
Polyphaser, P-O-L-Y-P-H-A-S-E-R. Papa Oscar Lima Yankee. Papa Hotel Alpha Sierra Echo Romeo.com.
.com, that makes it simple. Okay, I'll go ahead and maybe do a link if everybody's interested in that.
Yep, and I encourage you to link to the media library, particularly the white papers subsection, which has papers on literally everything we've talked about this evening.
W0JBR, did we have any more questions?
W0JBR, no, Joe. I think I got pretty highly educated tonight. Thank you.
Are there any comments or any other questions about lightning protection? Please call. Okay, are there any other questions out there for the net? Please call.
Just a quick comment, N7GES. I'm a little behind getting recordings uploaded, but I will get them the past couple weeks and this one up. Try to get them up this week if I can, probably toward the end of the week. N7GES.
That's absolutely fine. I thank you much for doing that. I hope they're being looked up and this and that. One other question that I had... Mark, what did you want me to link to?
Joe, I will send you URLs via email. And a separate request to talk about something that's been brought up slightly, and that is grounded antenna switches.
Go right ahead.
We've mentioned a couple different ways to disconnect your coax from your valuable, expensive radios. One is to physically disconnect the coax, which is excellent. There is another solution available, and that is an antenna switch. If you have more than one antenna coming into your radio, as I do, and a variety of people, Alpha, Delta, let's see, MFJ, the list goes on, sell antenna switches that have A and B, so the A antenna and the B antenna, and ground. So when you turn off your radio, you can switch the antenna selector switch to the ground position, which will connect both antennas, shields, and center connectors to each other and to ground. And obviously you need a connection out to a ground rod.
Okay, anything else?
Not from me.
You know, one thing that was brought up in conversations that we had earlier this year about this, and it was briefly brought up tonight, is to take the cable and put it in a glass jar. Did anybody care to comment about that?
Well, I will if no one else.
RKE0KBF. I remember as a kid, when my dad was always, you know, when the CBs were the big thing, every time there was a lightning storm, yep, he had an old mason jar that he'd undo the cable, and then as a kid, I always just sat there, you know, he'd always make sure I stayed away, but you could sit there and watch the spark arc across the end of that coax whenever there was a lightning storm around.
W2MAC, you want to go?
Sure. The idea is that after you have physically disconnected your coax from your radio, a lightning strike somewhere out there will induce a voltage difference on the two sides of your antenna. And that will be more than strong enough to cause a spark at the end of your coax inside your house between the center conductor and the shield. The idea of putting the end of the coax into some insulating something, a mason jar, a crock, a wine bottle if it's the right size, whatever, is that when that spark sparks, it will not ignite your carpet on fire, which is a bad thing. The alternative approach is to build a shorting bar and short the two sides of the antenna together, and that you do with a bulkhead connector, and you simply solder a big thick wire from the center conductor of the bulkhead connector to the chassis connection, in other words, where you would put a screw through the bulkhead connector, and put that onto the end of your coax. Doing so will keep both ends of your coax shorted together, and you will not get a differential voltage on the two legs of the antenna, and you will not get a spark. You may, however, get an absolute voltage on the antenna relative to the inside, so it's still a good idea to put the end, even with a shorting bar, inside some insulating material like a glass mason jar.
Understand, okay. I guess I was surprised because I thought that was kind of an old wives' tale, but apparently it does have some valid use.
Yep, you're drawing a spark with tens, hundreds, or even thousands of amps briefly, and that will ignite pretty much anything it's in contact with.
And the glass has enough insulation to hold that kind of voltage, huh? Wow, that's amazing. I would have thought just totally different than that. Anybody else have any comments?
W7LRY.
Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, my battery died on me, so I don't know if you heard me mention it or not, but I use just a regular RF relay. The reason being, you're going to wear out your coax connector if they're in springtime when you have a lot of storms. And the relay is 12 volts, so whenever the radio's on, it connects to the antenna. And when you turn the radio off, the relay automatically shuts and grounds everything to ground. So it saves wear and tear on your connector, and you're automatically grounded.
That's cool. I never thought about that. Any other comments? Any other questions? Well, okay, let's wrap this up tonight. We're just 5 minutes short of 2 hours. We've had about 26 check-ins, and this is kind of a record for us up here tonight. I'd like to thank each and every one of them, my experts and all this and that. I do appreciate that. Next week's Monday night presentation will be on software, not software-defined radio, but software tuning for radios. Can be as small as the RT versus the chirp stuff, or we can talk a little bit about the HRD stuff, too, so for HF. So if there's no other traffic at the net, I'd like to thank everybody who participated, and the repeaters over for general use. Everybody have a pleasant Thanksgiving.